being landowner-centric, I don't know, but in my mind, I'd like to think that it's more resilient long-term than only doing conservation on public land, because I feel like there's a long-term relationship that can be nurtured and passed on to the next landowner. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with you. I think that it is ultimately much more sustainable, but it requires that ongoing nurturing as well. It's not just like you're setting up a sustainable system and then because it's not on public land, it'll sort of produce the results continually. So I think the advantage of it happening on private land is that there's a level of attention and a level of, in the science world, it's called monitoring, but local people do it all the time. They know what's happening on their patch. If they're interested, they can tell you what the changes are from season to season. And they are the ones who will be capable of that ongoing monitoring in quite a citizen science-y way, or quite an ad hoc way, anecdotal way, I should say. But it needs to be respected, because that knowledge is often far more finger on the pulse than a desktop exercise or something where an agency comes in and says, this is what we should do across, we can see there's potential here and we have to do this across this area to make it work. So the sustainability really arises out of the curiosity, and the curiosity is a response to what's happening locally. Well, that's the way I see it anyway.
Hello, kia ora, and welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast, brought to you by Conservation Amplified.
Our show features the stories of people who are helping nature to bring more awareness to this amazing space.
I'm Anna.
And I'm Callum. And today, we're joined by Matu Booth from the Forest Bridge Trust. Matu, welcome.
Kia ora.
Thank you for coming here today. We're really excited to talk about the amazing mahi, the amazing work that you're doing to restore a bridge from west to east up near the Kaipara. So would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your project?
Yeah, thanks, Callum. I'm Matu Booth, Operations Manager for the Forest Bridge Trust. And the Forest Bridge Trust was formed in 2013 by a couple of local farmers who live at Glorit. They have a farm property of about 1,300 hectares, and had a moment in their farming lives where they decided that they could be adding more back, give more back to the environment than they'd been able to do just as farmers, and began by working with restoration on their farm, and locally set up the Mataya Restoration Trust in 2005. But eventually, so much pest control, active and effective pest control happening, that they were able to have kiwi released on their farm in 2013. And that was the first time, I believe, that kiwi were released on a working farm.
Wow.
But implication of that was that if that population did well, they would eventually need far more than just what Kevin and Jill had said could provide on their farm. So that was the germ of the idea that if pest control could be extended from the west coast on the Kaipara side of things, where that's where their farm was, if it could be extended and a habitat bridge formed through predator control, safe habitat for kiwi, there would one day perhaps be that population of kiwi expanding right across what was called the bridge, Forest Bridge, and it would be able to link up with kiwi which were behind the fence at that stage at Tawharanui, the regional park at Tawharanui, the Kiwi have made their way around the fence and begun to have begun to establish on the outside of Tawharanui. And more recently, there's another population of Kiwi being established at on Mount Tamahanga, very close to Matakana. That's the beginning of the East Coast population of North Island Kiwi. So that's the genesis of the dream. But I think there's also another component of it, which is an important sort of social component, which I think sets the project apart. And that was that Kevin and Jill had, as farmers, always were held that belief that conservation was best handled or best propelled by landowners and local knowledge. And so there was this real emphasis right from the start about empowering farmers and landowners to recognise the potentials and the opportunities for conservation, but also to be the ones who were making a landscape scale project possible by a concerted effort in the first place. So that really set it aside, and I think those are the social and the ecological germs that sit at the very genesis of this project.
What type of landowners was it? Was it all farms, or was there a bit of forestry or iwi land blocks, or was there some public land in between that you had to work with?
Yes, there is some pockets of dock estate, very small though. It is mostly quite large landowners on the west coast. The Kaipara Hills have some very old generational farmers there as well. When we received Save the Kiwi funding in 2020, really that gave us the fuel to the machine, really, to 5 years of funding is rare in conservation, certainly rare again now anyway.
Indeed.
But 5 years of secured funding is a real privilege. And it gave the organisation, the Forest Bridge Trust, the ability to shape, to strategize rather than just being hand to mouth. And one of the parts of that strategy was to, through Save the Kiwi, our goal, our KPI, if you want to put it that way, was to get 54,000 hectares under mustelid control. So that means with a mustelid predator network of traps, and thereby secure that bridge. This was the whole reason behind it. And so to put that into practice, we needed a predator team, obviously, to go and deploy those traps across the landscape. But it was recognised right from the start that we needed a large community engagement team. So quite rare for a small organisation. Presently we have 26 staff and 4 dedicated community liaison. Yeah. And that balance of having so many people involved with the engagement of the community is, and I'm rounding back to your question here, Callum, the social landscape across that bridge is quite complex. It's large landowners, but as you come across to the East Coast, there's a lot of lifestyle blocks there, a lot of small kind of seaside lifestyle blocks as well. So we work with 2 iwi, Ngāti Whātua and Ngāti Manahiri, on the west coast and the east coast. That complexity is reflected in the fact that we have around 800 landowners in our CRM, and really, I guess the way to think about that is that's 800 landowners, and that's just thousands upon thousands of conversations that you are having, not just to allow get a license so you can put your traps on their properties. That's only a tiny bit of the whole gig here, because the engagement really sits with ongoing maintenance of those traps. Mm. And the only way that anybody's going to keep setting their trap is if they have some idea that they're making a difference, or that one day what they're doing might significantly alter the habitat so that there would be kiwi able to exist in their neighborhood. So that's an answer to what sort of landowners are through there. It's quite complex, and we've had to adjust. We've had to grow the organization to match it.
Lots of variation. I can imagine that there would be a lot of different levels on the spectrum of conservation awareness. When you go to different landowners, some people might know what you're doing and why and be on board from day dot, and others, maybe there's a lot of education around this is why it's important, and re-education, and when owners change, making sure they're brought into the fold. Did you find that there were challenges with engaging landowners in general, or were most people somewhat understanding and on board, or was it quite a sale to some people?
Oh, the whole continuum, for sure. We have a very skilled, a CL, community liaison team. Yeah. I'm just in awe of the way that they have just infiltrated the community with, like, mycelium. You know, I mean, they just collectively, that they're four women, and they are just so skillful at those conversations. But I think we go back to the original ideals of the trust, and the Forest Bridge Trust was very much based on the values, very values-based, respect, empathy, and integrity. And I guess that's much more than just a banner for us, a headline, because we've always considered that what the landowners consider the greatest worth of conserving or putting their energy into is often where we should start that conversation. So a good example is our funding allows us to put out mustelid traps, and we're also able to deploy possum traps. Save the Kiwi recognises that those possum traps, at the density that we can deploy them, are really just a conversation starter. But, you know, for so many people, that's where the conversation starts. You know, it's more about that there's a possum in my backyard eating my lemons and, you know, or destroying my fruit on my tree. And that is more meaningful than a conversation about, hey, in 15 years, you might be able to have kiwi roaming in your back garden or so. So I think there's a real understanding that those conversations and conservation, it's only going to be fertile and take root where there's interest and curiosity in the first place. That can often be for the pure conservationists among us, can often be a conversation that is seems insignificant or even in the wrong direction. Can I just give a brief example of something from another part of, this is not Forest Bridge Trust, but I think it's a beautiful example. I previously worked at Namanu Nature Reserve, and that was set up by Peter McKenzie as a site that the public could visit. And one of the things that we had there was, it was a place that children and families used to come all the time, and we would sell $2 bags of duck food. And believe me, the mallards used to drive me absolutely nuts there. When I first arrived, I couldn't understand what value they were. I could only see that the shit was on the doorstep, sort of thing, you know. It was hard to kind of see, but it was always Peter's view that conservation started with that, for children feeding mallards. And I gradually understood that was a really powerful way of seeing where conservation starts. It's often those side conversations. So back to the Forest Bridge Trust, of course, you know, it's not that sort of gig, but it is respecting what is important locally and then thinking on a landscape scale beyond that. But you've got to start, your curiosity and your appreciation has to start at that local level. And as an organisation, I think Forest Bridge Trust just get that.
I think that's a really, both of them are really beautiful examples of meeting people at their current level. And I think that if you are, you know, going off public land, that's the crucial thing to do, is you have to, you know, meet the people where they're at in their journey and try and take them along. And on that note, have you found that, you know, wanting to connect Kiwi habitat, that's quite a nice driver for people to get motivated, like saving our national icon?
Yeah, it's a very powerful driver. It has given us a singular focus as an organisation. So our funding, as I said, has our last 5 years, we've got another year of it, has been via Save the Kiwi, Jobs for Nature via Save the Kiwi. And that, it's a bit of a two-edged sword sometimes, because it has given our organisation an incredible focus. It makes it very clear, everyone recognises at this present phase of the Forest Bridge Trust that we are talking about Kiwi. And yet, you know, we all know that Kiwi in this regard is a powerful motivating species, but it's a thin end of the wedge in a way, because there's a lot of other species that would thrive on the other side of the fence at Tawharanui if the landscape was cut in their favour a little bit more, meaning less rodents, for instance, or different sorts of control. So the great thing about Kiwi is they're incredibly robust as a species, and they will thrive in habitats that don't seem that conducive to them in the first place. So even we know now that even pine forests can offer Kiwi habitat. It's not the sort of habitat that too many species can thrive in. So,
But isn't it amazing how that bird just captivates people, and then there's so much more, like you said, other species will benefit. It's just that initial captivation. Oh yeah, we're saving Kiwi, let's get on board. And then there's this ripple on effect, isn't there?
Yeah, and there's other species that can ride on the coattails of Kiwi up here that are beginning to become more established, especially up the east coast. Kaka are one species that are well established at Tawharanui. Again, will thrive with, you know, just a sort of thin end of the wedge of pest control. They will do okay. Korimako are re-establishing their presence here. And there's even been reports of kakariki. Outside of the park. So, you know, there's potential there for a lot more. And these are just, of course, we tend to get hung up and be talking about bird species all the time because, you know, they're the most obvious. But there's such a lot of ways of improving and enhancing habitat for a range of biodiversity, whether it be flora or fauna. And it all starts with those conversations. But yeah, you're right. I mean, Kiwi are just, they seem to have that ability to enchant. Perhaps it's partly because under the cover of darkness, nobody quite knows where they're up to in their, as they're beginning to spread out across the landscape. It's almost got that quality of a beautiful positive virus. Something that's
going to continue one day. That brings us really nicely to this question. What does this project, the Forest Bridge Trust, mean for your region? Thinking about if you keep growing what you're doing, what kind of future can be imagined?
Well, the Forest Bridge Trust's what we call our area of interest is basically the Rodney area. So it's north of, in roughly a line across from South Head, Helensville, across to Orewa, and then north to Te Poroporo and Mangawhai in the north. So about 130,000 hectares. And as I mentioned, our KPI is to get 54,000 hectares under masterless control. We're fortunate that we have in our team an amazing ecologist who, right at the start of the project, did a desktop exercise of mapping the corridors that Kiwi would be most likely to use to make their way across that bridge. So she identified four what are called least cost corridors. So these were the areas that we needed to concentrate on to have an effect across that bridge. And the Kiwi are behaving just as Virginia suggested they might. So they're showing up in these corridors where they haven't been previously. And if you were just to look at a map, you wouldn't necessarily have picked the same corridors of transit that Virginia could identify. So it's beginning from that perspective. And I'm kind of getting to what you're asking there, Callum. The regional effect is we're not the only game in town by any means. Forest Bridge Trust have a landscape scale goal here. But long before the trust were established, there have been lots of community groups doing the hard work for a long time at a local level with sometimes very local outcomes in mind, you know. And these are the organisations that we've been able to work with and say, here's another layer of the predator control picture that might be able to supplement and enhance what you're doing. So we certainly haven't gone in and tried to alter what they're doing. We're just saying, for the sake of the regional perspective and for the sake of this species, here's a way that we can unite all of that effort and maybe exact an even greater outcome than all of the individual groups can. So in a regional sense, I think one way to look at it is at a species level, one species at a time is then added back into that picture. Kiwi, maybe kaka, maybe North Island robin, or, you know, they all begin to take their place in that assemblage. But just going back to those original two germs that kicked the Forest Bridge Trust, the other thing that hopefully persists and is sustained beyond the funding that we've been given is that network of conversations that's been encouraged under the guise of the Forest Bridge Trust to for the sake of Kiwi. Those conversations actually begin to connect communities together for other outcomes. And once the community is connected for the sake of its environment, then it has the choice of where it wants to shine the light and where it wants to exercise the mahi next, you know. So I think regionally that's what we would really hope our legacy is.
So I guess that means, yes, you're increasing biodiversity, but also while you're at it, you're kind of creating a sense of belonging and increasing community wellness.
Yeah, that figures very largely in our vision statement, our mission statements, that sense of connected communities, connected to their environment. Those are the things that we really see the sustainability of an effort like ours sitting upon. So exactly, you've got it.
And yep. As far as what the project means for Rodney, Are there any economic impacts? Like, is there any way it could be viewed from, I mean, I'm thinking, yes, having healthier ecosystems means cleaner water, means cleaner air, means potentially tourism, but I'm just speculating here. What is there any kind of economic benefit that you would expect or hope from what you're doing?
Well, the collaborations that come through partnering with other organisations, whether they be from a community, you know, as a local and community organisation, through to the relationships that we have developed previously with Auckland Council and are looking to pick up again, those collaborations are economically really important in this next phase of conservation going through a very narrow, tight time where funding won't be as available as it has been. So there's a couple of different ways of looking at it. Yes, I mean, there's obvious positive outcomes in terms of being able to advertise your region as somewhere you can go and see kiwi or hear kiwi or encounter a more biodiverse area. I think there's just a huge sort of goal in terms of getting to a place where that particular economic value or that particular economic outcome is valued by everybody in the region. So it's sort of like it's up there in terms of, yes, that's the sort of place that we want to live. Those are the sort of nature values that we think would make living in that area ideal. And that's the sort of thing that comes about when you've got engagement at every level. So people are setting a trap with the same sort of regularity, the same sort of mundane attitude that you might cart out your recycling to the front gate. That's, you know, setting a trap to look after your local biodiversity. It's just taken for granted as one of the things that you do. And that becomes pervasive right through all levels of the community.
That would be amazing.
That would be, if that can become part of our daily life, that we just set the trap or check the trap for starters before we leave our house, that would be pretty good.
Yeah, I like that you're focusing your work on bringing back kiwi and bringing back these other species rather than the focus being on killing stuff that doesn't belong here. I mean, that is an important part of predator control by the nature of the name predator control, but focusing on what we want to save is so much more constructive, and it's so much more conducive to bringing people together than let's kill stuff.
It has to be a balance. And I think, again, you know, hats off to our community liaison team. They understand that not all conversations are killing conversations. Not all conversations are about moving the bad stuff out, but celebrating and being aware and having curiosity about what takes its place. So often those gains are sometimes quite small, but they're, you know, conversations to be cherished and showcased whenever they happen.
Yeah,
and it's important to celebrate our wins. And to me, what you're doing, you know, bringing kiwi back on a large scale, that's something it's 100% worth celebrating, isn't it? It's amazing.
Yeah, and that's right. I guess we could have all of those traps out and be persuading landowners to be doing that landowner by landowner and set up properties, set up traps property by property. But there's so much to be gained by getting people to consider what's happening across landscapes in the same way that, the animals they're protecting move across landscapes in that way. And so do the predators that we're trying to suppress. So really the only response to both those things, either the positive or the negative side of those, is to apply yourself at a landscape level And that means that people are encouraged to be thinking at a catchment level or at the level of this particular forest that's over here, this remnant forest, it's not on my property, but it's going to enhance and affect what happens on my property and maybe my neighbours as well. So it needs to happen at that landscape perspective. And we're quite fortunate, really, that kiwi are sort of, they're a species that can be tracked through the landscape in quite a methodical way as they begin to spread and, distribute themselves across the environment. Yeah. So,
coming back to something you said earlier, you're unique in that you're landowner first, landowner driven, and you are a catchment sized group. In many ways, when I think about community conservation, I think about something on public land that people are volunteering to give their time on the weekend or in their free time to get to do. And that's quite fundamentally different to your approach. So being landowner centric, how is your way of doing conservation different? What are the benefits and what are the challenges of that?
I think you alluded to one of the challenges quite early on is it's not static, that landscape, that social landscape or that physical landscape. So from a physical perspective, a year ago we had these amazing storms up here which just obliterated or just changed landscape, especially in the catchments where a lot of farmers have their livelihood. So huge amounts of sediment entered the Kaipara Harbour and lots of huge slips, really catastrophic changes to landscape in that perspective. At the same time, that social landscape is also dynamic. So as you said, Callum, you can have a conversation with a landowner and get them set up with traps and they move on. They decide that's actually, that's not where they're going to be living. And so that conversation has to start all over with somebody new. And it makes you realize how dynamic both the physical landscape, but at the social landscape is as well. You're never there. You're always just attending to the fabric, making sure that it's a moving target and you're constantly repairing it or enhancing it. So that becomes the, once that's understood, then it's a bit like gardening, I suppose, on a landscape scale. I mean, you're never finished when you're gardening. You're always weeding or tending to your garden to make sure the next thing is coming on. I mean, it's never just throw the seeds in and go back in 3 months' time and harvest. It's an ongoing process. And kaitiakitanga at a landscape level is the same. It's asking for curiosity to be renewed and refreshed constantly.
Being landowner-centric, I don't know, but in my mind, I'd like to think that it's more resilient long-term than only doing conservation on public land, because I feel like there's a potential long-term relationship that can be nurtured and passed on to the next landowner. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I agree with you. I think it is ultimately much more sustainable, but it requires that ongoing nurturing as well. It's not just like you're setting up a sustainable system and then because it's not on public land, it'll sort of produce the results continually. So I think the advantage of it happening on private land is that there's a level of attention and a level of, in the science world, it's called monitoring, but local people do it all the time. They know what's happening on their patch. If they're interested, they can tell you what the changes are from season to season. And they are the ones who will be capable of that ongoing monitoring in quite a citizen science-y way or quite an ad hoc way, anecdotal way, I should say. But it needs to be respected because that knowledge is often far more finger on the pulse than a desktop exercise or something where an agency comes in and says, this is what we should do across, we can see there's potential here and we have to do this across this area to make it work. So the sustainability really arises out of the curiosity, and the curiosity is a response to what's happening locally. Well, that's the way I see it anyway. So
that makes a lot of sense.
Reminds me of a quote that I'm going to botch, and I apologize in advance. It goes something to the effect of, an observant local will always know more than a passing expert. And to me, if you've got skin in the game and you care about your land, your whenua, you're going to know more, you're going to do more, and you're going to have more attachment. I think that, in my opinion at least, that sets you apart. But also that is a connecting thread with community conservation on public land, is it's a local, it's a person that cares about their forest and they want to go away and give something back. But I guess when it's tied to your ownership, it's also tied to so much more that it means to you.
Well, it becomes part of your legacy, right?
I agree. And, you know, I mean, the legacy of a community was something that was a lot more palpable, a lot more tangible in earlier times, I think. A community that got together at the community hall and shared some outcomes that were real rather than virtual. This was one way that a community could sort of have an identity through time, because it was doing things together and it was respecting all of those very local opinions and views together. So it was collectivizing them, but it was still having outcomes that were, I don't know, almost, they were almost sort of just a byproduct of the way that people lived. I mean, we try to manufacture the same thing now in a way, because bringing people together for the cause of conservation, bringing them together to do a community trap line or gathering them together in hubs, it's a sort of an artificial thing because we're providing something that communities used to have inherently as part of what they did. But it's damn strong. It's a very strong motivating thing. And, you know, even though the community hall has gone by the by, that need to be coming together for a collective outcome is still super, I don't know what the next word is, super something.
Super epic. I've never thought of it that way. It's such a cool perspective.
Yeah.
Super epic. That's my new quote. Yeah. Super epic. So let's say I want to do something to help nature. I don't do anything for conservation right now. What can I do? What tips and advice would you share to practically, on an action basis, do something?
Okay. You know, the obvious one would be that you could expect anyone in my situation to say is, oh, we have a volunteer network. We could, yeah, you know, if you want to volunteer, come and join a volunteer trap line, we can find one for you. And that would be super epic of you if you chose to do that. You know, that would definitely tick boxes, and it would be a really pragmatic way of getting involved. But there are other subtler ways of starting to take an interest in your local area. And it could be, a lot of our staff have practiced, become quite adept at 5-minute bird counts recently. So a 5-minute bird count is an accepted way of observing a trend in biodiversity over time. But you don't have to even have 10 stations 200 meters apart to do a 5-minute bird count. You can stand in your garden on a particular day, 3 months apart, you know, continually or once a month, and just stand for 5 minutes and go, okay, I'm going to count. It's a bit like the 5 minute bird count that the garden survey that's operating at the moment. That kind of, if we just back off and go, yeah, that produces some cool citizen science and some cool ways of looking at the world. Back off from that as kind of, yes, you're producing something, from simply kind of going, okay, I'm going to exercise my curiosity about my immediate surroundings by listening and seeing what's there and what changes over time. So that's at the very most local level. And I think once you've ignited that curiosity, then you just can't help but wonder what it's like. I wonder if my neighbour has the same number of blackbirds I seem to have here, or tui, if you're lucky enough to go that way. You know, and then you've got that starter where it becomes landscape thinking, which in this case just means outside of your boundary of your property, really. It can start at a very, very small level. That's one way of getting involved in conservation. It doesn't sound like it is, but without that curiosity, then conservation is just a real piece of drudgery, which you can be tending your trap line for 20 years and taking out the pests, and that's a-okay, that's fine. But so much the better if you've got your head up occasionally and there's some other driver, some other reason for doing it, which begins, in my estimation, with curiosity.
Yeah, and planting a seed, I guess, that curiosity blooms if it's something that you're into. We went on a nature cruise, sounds really cliche when I say it like that, over Christmas, and there were heaps of birders and naturalists, and I didn't understand what a birder was until we went there. The most amazing people. But there was this app they were using called iNaturalist, I think it was, and they would something similar, but they'd take photos and recordings and upload it and then compare who's seen and spotted which birds. It was quite cool.
Well, iNaturalist is just the most amazing app, so yeah, it can be a bit without traction, your curiosity, if it hasn't got something like iNaturalist to back it up. And iNaturalist is just pretty easy to work for most people. And it's just like having a little buddy on your shoulder saying, you going, wow, I've just seen this. And iNaturalist goes, oh, that is this. And on iNaturalist you're also told how many other people have seen it in the same area and whether it's common or not, and you just learn things from that way of involvement. So yeah, iNaturalist is fantastic. I love it.
Actually, talking about apps, there's one other app I really want to give a shout out to, Aotearoa Species Identifier, which is this AI tool. It's a collaboration between some universities and some AI incubators, and it's more for plants, but you can take a photo of any plant around the country and it will then tell you with a percentage probability which species it is, and then bring in the Wikipedia description of it, the English name, the te reo name, the Latin name, and then any other probabilities of the top five species it could be. And so, and it works offline. Oh, cool. So we go into the forest and we look around, and we play this game where we see who can spot a plant that the other person can't name, and then if we can't get it and we're stumped, we'll take a photo. And I was claiming that every moss yesterday was old man's beard, and I said no, and I said I'm going to prove you wrong, and it turns out she was right that I was wrong because of the Aotearoa Species Identifier.
What's it called? Aotearoa
Species Identifier. Actually, I'll just check. I'm pretty sure that's what it's called. Aotearoa Species Identifier. It's I think it's on the App Store.
I love the curiosity point, hey? Because if you're curious, that makes you passionate. So when you meet the next person, they're going to be so much more intrigued by your curiosity and passion than if you were to start your conservation conversation on facts. I feel like if you can showcase your own curiosity, you kind of, you can rope people in so much easier, because we all have that curious little child in us that wants to know, but sometimes we're trained to not look that way until someone starts and points those cool things out to us, and off we go following that path.
Yeah, it's very true, Anna. I think one of the things that make me very aware of that is I became involved in conservation quite late. I was a late starter, but I always had curiosity. I just didn't know that it was, best put to kind of my observational skills were best suited to that sort of thing. So it's not helpful for anybody, for conservationists to kind of, people who are into conservation, to feel precious about the knowledge that they have. That's not going to help any of the things that they love to thrive by using that as your first engagement. So, I think that's the beautiful thing that I recognize in our community liaison team, again, just to laud them, is actually they're not conservationists either. They weren't conservationists before they were communicators. And all of them are so great at about translating that passion that they have, got caught up to the people who are like them, who are just starting the journey often, and somehow they make trapping seem appealing.
Yeah. So conservation has many different lenses. It wears many different faces and many different clothes. Conservation has many different ways of playing out in our lives. What does conservation mean to you, Matu?
Look, I'm going to be not as prosaic as you're hoping for here. This is a little bit, woo-woo, but it's got a lot to do with giving things the place that they can live, providing home for all sorts of creatures. Now, conservation, of course, we've got a whole lot of creatures that we want to give homes to and a whole lot that we want to deprive of homes, but essentially in that process, if we just describe it like killing on this hand, letting these ones thrive, then it becomes a bit grim at times, because you just end up with a tally of the dead, and as you say, the other side of things is the balance. But there's something else that's happening in that process as well, and it's the emphasis on habitat. That's what conservation is about for me. It's sort of starting from the perspective of habitat or home. You're supplying places that species can thrive, and you are trying to get a whole lot of different pieces of that conversation to be talking to each other. So a biodiversity picture that's working has a whole lot of those pieces of the jigsaw, a whole lot of those conversations working to supply homes for a whole lot of things simultaneously. We tend to be a bit focused at the moment on kiwi, and that is great because, it's just, we've already talked about what an iconic species it is. But ultimately, conservation is about enhancing the potential for lots of species to be able to thrive and to have within that space to have safe home. So that's what it means to me.
Okay.
As an operations manager, I'm often just counting the number of traps and trap boxes that have gone out into the field, though. So, there's as you say, there's different bites of the cherry.
Yeah, it's a beautiful way of looking at it.
Yeah. So going a little bit more further down that rabbit hole, what does a healthy ecosystem look like to you and the Forest Bridge Trust? Like, what's successful future for you?
Well, we kind of loop back to something that we've mentioned earlier. So a healthy ecosystem will depend on people being curious and then people putting energy into things that are obvious to them to be changed or need to changed or to need to be protected. So it's funny, isn't it? You know, every time we start talking about, in our context, in the Forest Bridge Trust context of conservation and kaitiakitanga, it's always this, what does a healthy ecosystem look like? We start talking about the people again. So it really builds on that ability to recognize when things can be changed, making the right decisions to change them, and a healthy ecosystem isn't an isolated ecosystem. It's a catchment talking to all its integral parts. It's one catchment talking to another catchment. It's one remnant forest being able to link to another piece of forest. So things are pretty disintegrated these days. We're talking about a lot of little patches a lot of the time. So in many ways, a healthy ecosystem relies on connection and linkages in a physical way, and that is replicated and again at the way that we need to link communities to put those things back together. Yeah, I think that's where it starts for me.
So, let's say I live in Rodney, and I think from this podcast, what you're doing sounds awesome. How do I find out more about what you do, and how do I get involved?
Well, our website would be one way of getting more information about us. Yeah, there's lots of options. We do have community trap lines. We also are, there's lots of the community trapping groups that are already operating where we can direct you to be working with them. I mean, you don't have to be working for the Forest Bridge Trust to get the outcomes that are going to have a great effect in the landscape. So you could pick and choose which groups you want to be working with. For us, there are lots of opportunities for volunteers at all different levels of the organization. So right from the obvious level of going out and checking traps to supporting the organization through helping with our comms, with our photography, with checking our SD cards, which we bring in from our cameras for monitoring both pest species and other species for taking part in our Kiwi listening. There's a lot of different opportunities to be involved, that's for sure.
Cool. So go to the website. We'll put the link in the description. I find that helping communities with the environment, obviously it's good for the environment, but it's actually good for me. I keep coming back. I came for the nature and I keep coming back for the people. So Marta, it's been such a pleasure chatting with you today.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
I've personally learned heaps. It was quite, what's the word, super epic. Really appreciate it. And the work you're doing is so great. So all the best to you on that.
Yes.
Well, thanks so much.
Totally what Callum said.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for the work that you're doing too, just amplifying all of these stories that lie throughout the conservation landscape. It's, you know, what you're doing is super epic too. So I'm really proud to be part of it.
Super epic all around. Yeah. Cheers.
Cheers.